compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
How are you doing today? I hope it's a great day for you, and it's going to get even better for the two of us. If you give me a call, 888-914-9149. My name is Patrick Madrid. You probably already know that. And we have lines open right now, 888-914-9149. For the longest time, I have been talking about what's known as global aging. And if you've listened to this program for any length of time, you've heard me touch upon the topic here and there. And that has to do with how, historically at least, populations are expressed in the form of a pyramid. If you want to look at it in that expression, and the base of the pyramid is comprised of the youngest people in that population. And as you get higher up the pyramid, it narrows, of course, and that's because the ages of the people in those higher age groups tend, or the numbers rather, in those higher age groups tend to thin out. And that's standard because of disease or accidents or wars or, you know, the common things that typically happen in a given generation. And so by the time you get to the apex of the pyramid, that smallest portion of the pyramid is comprised of the oldest people. That's how it's pretty much been since time immemorial. And populations in every part of the world are typically expressed that way. Well, things have been changing for 50 plus years now. And that is as a result, I think, largely because of contraception and certainly because of abortion. Think of the countless millions of people who should be here who aren't. Well, what's happening is the number of younger people in proportion to the number of older people is declining. And in some cases, it's such a startling decline that countries, and I'm going to share with you some statistics here, some countries are really panicking. What are we going to do? China's one of them, by the way. They had that stupendously stupid one-child policy, not to mention horrible because it forcibly killed countless millions of Chinese babies because their moms were not allowed to have more than one child. And when mom shows up pregnant, you know, the doctor and nurse would show up at the house and they would forcibly perform abortions. This went on for generations in China. Well, they frantically changed the one-child policy in recent years to a two-child policy because they realized the demographic problems that even China, with all its people, were going to be getting into. And now it looks as though they're abandoning or shortly will abandon the two-child policy and encourage people to have more children. It might be too late for China. We'll see what happens. But you may say, how can that be with all those people? How can that possibly be? Well, here's what global aging entails. For various reasons, whether it's the stupidity of a one-child policy on the part of a government, or it is rampant contraception, rampant abortion, all these things combine to lessen the number of people who are being born. Okay, fair enough. But now on the plus side of the equation, you and I live in a generation where we have the benefit of very advanced medicine and medicines. So you can, by and large, live a longer, healthier life. I remember when I was a kid in the 60s, it seemed to me, I'd have to go back and check some records, but I think I'm right on this, and anecdotally at least, I remember where people would croak at, you know, a relatively young age, and nobody blinked an eye. So if a guy dropped dead at 65 of a stroke or a heart attack, it was like, okay, that was his time. Nowadays, if somebody dies in his 60s or her 60s, it's considered way too young because we've become accustomed to the benefits of the state of the art of medicine, which enable people, because of the drugs and the procedures and the science that now we can bring to bear on these problems, people can live longer lives. And that's great. And I'm all about that. I like that. I like living in the era of Advil and air conditioning. May I say to you? So I've got no complaints when it comes to the medical prowess that we now have. I wish that everybody enjoyed that around the world, but in any case, we have it. So here's where the problem comes in. Because older people are living longer, and older people are living longer into old age, I guess it's kind of the same way of saying what I just said, there are more of them. And proportionate to the whole, there are at least proportionate to the number of old people. And don't be offended by the word old. It's a real word. We might as well, you know, deal with reality as it is. No need to be offended. There are increasingly larger numbers of older people and increasingly fewer numbers of younger people. So this pyramid that we talked about a few moments ago, it's actually sort of turning upside down. And it's not upside down yet, but in some countries, it looks like it's going to go full upside down because the number of young people is so dramatically lower than what it needs to be that these populations can't even sustain their current population level. And Japan is a great example of this. And there's an article you really should read if you want to understand this phenomenon and how it's taking place all around the world. Let me read to you some snippets from it. The number of births registered in Japan plummeted to another record low last year. The latest worrying statistic in a decades-long decline that the country's authorities have failed to reverse despite their extensive efforts. The country saw 799,728 births in 2022. That may sound like a lot. The lowest number on record, and it's the first ever dip below 800,000, according to statistics released by the Japanese government. That number has nearly halved in the past 40 years. By contrast, in 1982, Japan had 1.5 million births. You see where this is headed? So the number of births in Japan in the span of time, roughly 40 years, has been cut in half. Japan also reported a record high for post-war deaths last year at more than 1.5 million. So they get into some of the demographics by population size. Deaths have outpaced births in Japan for more than a decade, posing a growing problem for leaders of the world's third largest economy. They now face a ballooning elderly population. Remember that part? Along with a shrinking workforce to do what? To do things like fund pensions and healthcare as the demand from the aging population surges. So people in that group, and as they get progressively older, they need more things, medically speaking. Certainly they need pensions because they're no longer working. They're retired now, so they're not building things. They're not fixing things. They're not inventing things. They're not bringing things to the market. They're consuming because their golden years now are the time to rest after all their hard work, and that's to be expected, and that's what they'd like to do. But who's going to pay the pension? Well, it's the worker. It's the people who are building things and inventing things and bringing things to market and clocking in and clocking out, and the wages and the taxable income that goes to support things like pensions. There are fewer and fewer of those people. Japan's population, back to the article, has been in steady decline since its economic boom in the 80s, and it stood at 125.5 million in 2021. Now, we don't have the most recent figures yet. But the problem is that Japan has a fertility rate of 1.3. What that means is that for women of a childbearing age, so within the childbearing age bracket, let's just say that's from 18 to say 40. And demographers might, you know, they might change those numbers slightly up or down a little bit, but let's just say it's from 18 to 40. That's generally considered the bracket of women who are in childbearing age. And in order for a population just to simply stay flatline, not grow, not shrink, there needs to be an average of 2.1 children born for women in that childbearing age bracket. Japan is at 1.3. So at 2.1, a population, all other things being equal, is going to more or less be in a steady state. It's going to flatline, and there will be enough people being born to offset the number of people who are dying, and things are going to be okay. They're not great because it's not a population that's growing. It's not a population that is expanding its younger workforce, but at least it's going to hold steady. But Japan is an example of a country that's way below that. So what that means is that the population of Japan is imploding. Japan also has, now this is a blessing, but there's a double-edged sword effect here. Japan has among the highest of life expectancies in the world. Let me give you an example. In 2020, nearly one in 1,500 in nearly one in 1,500 people in Japan were 100 years old or older. They tend to live a lot longer than most of the rest of us do in the rest of the world. So the Prime Minister of Japan says that it is on the brink of not being able to maintain social functions. And you may say, what does that mean? Well, it's called a social contract in other contexts. And that means when you get old, don't worry, we're going to take care of you. We, the government, we have programs and plans to give you assistance, and you're not going to starve, and you're not going to go homeless. We're going to make sure you have medical care, even if it's rudimentary. We're not going to abandon you to the elements. You are going to be taken care of in some way or another, and we, the government, are going to back that up. That's what he's saying. Social functions extends to things like that, things that you and I take for granted here, things like, well, not everybody takes Social Security for granted. I mean, that's been a political football for forever. And let's just assume that we take Social Security for granted, at least in the short term. Medicare, Medicaid, welfare, WIC, all the other countless programs that we have to support people in this country if they fall through the cracks. What he's saying is we're not going to be able to do that anymore. So you may say, all right, well then, what's going to happen? Read the rest of the article. There's quite a bit there. What's going to happen to these people? And not just in Japan, by the way. What's going to happen? Put yourself in that situation. You're elderly. You are now on a fixed income. You've got a pension, perhaps. You got some Social Security. And you're doing okay. You're doing fine. You can pay the bills and then some. If this trend continues, and there's no reason to think it won't, certainly not in places like Western Europe and the U.S. and Canada and Japan and Russia and all of these other places around the world that are experiencing this, it will lead to a renegotiation of the social contract, which I don't see how you get around the possibility that that renegotiation means, remember all that stuff we said about how we're going to take care of you? And remember all that stuff we were telling you about how, you know, we've got programs and assistance? We can't do that anymore because there are just too many old people. They're living too long and they're consuming because that's what old people do. They've worked hard and it's time for them to rest now. But I'm really sorry. We just don't have enough young people who are being born anymore to sustain what we've got going here. So we're going to have to make a few changes. And my prediction has always been, and I hate to, you know, every time I bring it up, I hate to bring it up, but it must be confronted, and that is the possibility, the specter of governments in places like Japan or China or elsewhere, including like our backyard, might get to the point where they say, you know, I realize this is not how we planned it. It's not what you are thinking, but times are different. We don't have the money. You've had a great life. You've lived a long time. And you now are at a point where you're kind of a burden. I hate to put it that way, but you're kind of a burden. And what about all the young people? They didn't get a chance yet to grow old, and they're still working. And yeah, they're not having kids, that's true. But, you know, they're still working, and they want their toys, and they want their MTV. And is this kind of a burden for them for so much of their payroll earnings to get diverted to take care of people who are no longer working? They're just kind of a burden. And you don't want to be a burden, do you? You don't want to be a burden. You don't want to be a burden on somebody else, do you? Do you see how quickly and easily that could sway hearts and minds of people? Not just the people who are being told this, but what about the other people? Yeah, that's right. All those old people, they're a burden. Why do I have to pay for them? How come I have to work so hard? All I want is my game system and beer in the fridge and my cell phone connection and all that. That's all I really
want.
They
have their turn. Now it's my turn.
Exactly. Exactly. See, you see what I'm saying, Cyrus. They're a burden. And you didn't want to be a burden. You wouldn't want to be a burden yourself, would you?
Sounds like Logan's Run.
Did you know that Soylent Green is people? Different program, different movie.
Yeah, same idea, I guess.
So if you were on in years, Cyrus, and things were tight, and this kind of social upheaval was going on, and the demographics in these United States were even more in free fall than they are right now. We're being saved solely by immigration. Thank God for the immigrants. I mean, say what you want about immigration policy. This country would be in dire straits. Talk about I want my MTV. This country would be in dire straits if we didn't have the immigration propping us up, because our birth rate is ridiculously low. It's not as bad as Japan, but it's trending in that direction. So, Cyrus, if you were in that situation and, you know, the people in the white coats came to you and sat by your bed and said, you know, what do you think? We can make this so easy. It's just like, you know, take a little medicine, drift off to sleep. Everything's great. Your family will be there. By the way, they're going to get some tax credits if you decide to do the right thing, you know, like not be a burden.
Like I would be given the choice.
Exactly. I think it would be, I think, and here, and let's face it, here's what we're talking about. We're talking about what could amount to forced euthanasia. And at first, I think it would be candy-coated, and it would be portrayed as like that young woman, Brittany Menard. We talked about her several years ago. Beautiful, lovely young woman who had a terrible form of brain cancer, and she decided to have assisted suicide rather than go through the rigors of this illness, and she was hailed as a hero. She did the right thing, everybody said, and what a courageous, noble person she was. And my heart breaks for her and her family, and they're still dealing with her loss, but we already are living in a society where people have been conditioned to regard certain kinds of suicide, not the Robin Williams kind, but other kinds, like the Brittany Menard kind, as being heroic and selfless and doing something for other people. And my concern is that it's going to continue trending in that direction. So when you see articles like this, we have to take a break, but when you see articles like this, just know this is a real thing. It's really happening in real time around the world. And part of the solution, maybe even the most fundamental part of all, of course, is be open to life. Be open to life. Do what God said. He said, be fruitful and multiply. And God's pretty smart. You know, when you think about it, he has a lot of things figured out. Among them, that people need people and societies need young people. And if you don't have young people, the society dies. So even just for you as a microcosm of humanity, you and your wife, you and your husband, you and your family, be open to life. Be part of the solution to this problem. And even if nothing else, when you grow older, you're going to be surrounded by people who love you. You won't be destitute and alone and wishing, oh, I wish I had had children, or I wish I had had more than one child. You won't have those kinds of regrets, because you will be surrounded by people who love you and will support you and take care of you, even if the government won't. All right. That article will be posted post-haste. You can find it. There we go. I get what you're doing, Cyrus. I like it. You'll find the article on the show page, relevantradio.com/Patrick. I will be right back with your phone calls. This hour sponsored by Notre Dame Federal Credit Union, where you can boost your savings with their 14-month share certificate, earning a 4.14% annual percentage yield. Info at relevantradio.com/certificate.
This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and relevantradio.com.
Here we go. Let's go to Michael now in Wisconsin. Good morning, Michael. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you. I can't believe I'm on your program.
Well, here we are. Isn't it great?
Yeah, I listen to you every day. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I have a question, and I was telling the lady when she asked my question, it sounds kind of sacrilegious, but I want to ask because it's been bothering me for a long time.
Sure.
And that's why, I know we can't understand God's infinite wisdom, but I wonder why he created the serpent to begin with that would eventually turn Adam and Eve into evil.
Well, he didn't turn them into evil. He turned them toward evil. That's true, but they didn't become evil. Yeah.
Right.
But why did that's a fair question. I tell you, Michael, I'm going to be completely frank with you. That's among the questions that I have for God. I'm sure they'll all be answered when I get to heaven, God willing. But one would be like, Lord, why did you create snakes? Yeah, I know, you know, the ecosystem and they eat mice and there's, you know, the rhythm of life and all that. I understand that, Lord, I do. But could we have done it a different way, you know, without snakes and, you know, cockroaches and spiders and things like that? So I know the scientific answer, but I would be interested in asking the Lord that very question. And what's interesting is when you look at the passage, this is Genesis 3. So look at the passage. In verse 1, it says, now the serpent was more subtle than any other wild creature that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, did God say you shall not eat of any tree of the garden? So what I find striking about that is it gives the distinct impression that the serpent was just one of the many animals that God created and he told Adam to name. So in Genesis 2, in verses 19 and 20, we see that all these different animals were made and God told Adam to name them. That shows his dominion over the animals. And that included all kinds. So the snakes were already there, or at least a snake was already there. So my point is, it seems as though the evil one, he got into the body of a snake.
Right.
And you know what I'm saying? He in some way or another, we're told in Genesis 3:1 that God made these creatures. So he didn't make them bad. Obviously, they weren't bad from the beginning because God, after he created everything, we're told, he said, it is good. It is very good. And by nature, God, of course, cannot create anything evil. So one way to interpret Genesis 3:1 is that the devil got inside of an animal, got inside of a snake, and then used it to talk to Adam and Eve. One possibility. Another possibility is that he just took the form of a snake. But to your question, why did God create serpents? Why did he create them? I don't know the answer to that question. Other than that, that was part of the totality of God's plan for animal life in this on this planet anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right? So maybe it was possible that Satan, after he was kicked out of heaven, entered the body of the serpent as kind of revenge?
Well, it could have been revenge, but we know for sure that this was after the fall of the angels, those that fell. I mean, they couldn't have done this before they fell. So clearly after, that's true. Revenge, you know, what was his motive? Hatred, hatred of God, a desire to subvert the goodness that he saw in Adam and Eve? I don't know. We can speculate.
Right. Sure. Well, that answers my question. I'm still curious, but like you said, we'll find out in heaven.
Indeed. I'm sure there will be many surprises in store for us in heaven.
Right? Well, I'll let you go, Patrick. I have lots more questions, but we have time for other callers.
So, well, I appreciate
thank you for
that.
The information. Sure.
I appreciate that. Nice chatting with you, Michael. Stay warm and well fed. Let's go to Michelle now in Little Falls, Minnesota. Hi, Michelle.
Good morning. I was at my adoration hour this week, and while I was there, a mom and her teenage daughter stopped in, and after a little bit, I heard a commotion. The daughter fell to the floor, and she probably remained that way for at least a half an hour, 40 minutes while they were there. And she, part of the time that she was there, she was speaking in tongues. And, you know, when she fell, I looked at the mom and she said, you know, I was going to warn you, don't worry. She's okay. She had been a part of a retreat at our parish over the weekend, and kind of since then she had this has been happening to her. So I was just curious as to why, what that kind of means or why that happens to people. And I had never experienced something like that in my life.
Yeah. I can understand why it would be maybe a bit disconcerting for you. The first thing is, let's stipulate that the Bible is clear that some people, at least during the apostolic era, they had a charismatic gift of speaking in tongues. And St. Paul talks a bit about that, actually talks quite a bit about that in 1 Corinthians 14. I'll return to that in a moment. We know on the day of Pentecost, the apostles and other disciples had the gift of tongues in some sense. We don't know exactly whether or not they were speaking miraculously in foreign tongues that they didn't know so that people from other parts of the world could understand them, or if the gift was that they spoke in their own language, but the Holy Spirit enabled those who didn't speak Aramaic or Greek or Hebrew, most likely would have been Aramaic, that the Holy Spirit enabled them to understand those languages in their own way. It's hard to know exactly what it was, and the Bible doesn't say specifically. All we know is that that gap was bridged and that they could understand the apostles. So we know that that form of tongues exists. We also know that another form of tongues existed. St. Paul says in chapter 14 of 1 Corinthians, he talks about speaking in tongues. And he says, "For one who speaks in a tongue speaks not to men but to God, for no one understands him, but he utters mysteries in the Spirit. On the other hand, he who prophesies speaks to men for their upbuilding and encouragement and consolation. He who speaks in a tongue edifies himself, but he who prophesies edifies the church. Now I want you all to speak in tongues," he says, "but even more to prophesy. He who prophesies is greater than he who speaks in tongues, unless someone interprets so that the church may be edified." Now, you're going to see a pattern that he's laying down here about speaking in tongues is something private, and it's also not to be done in a group unless there is somebody who can interpret that. Otherwise, it just comes across like babbling. It comes across as incoherent to those who have no idea what this person is saying. So here's kind of a series of rules that he lays down. "Now, brethren," I'm in verse 6, "if I come to you speaking in tongues, how shall I benefit you unless I bring you some revelation or knowledge or prophecy or teaching? If even lifeless instruments such as the flute or the harp do not give distinct notes, how will anyone know what is played? And if the bugle gives an indistinct sound, who will get ready for battle? So, with yourselves, if you in a tongue utter speech that is not intelligible, like that girl was doing, how will anyone know what is said? For you will be speaking into the air. There are doubtless many different languages in the world, and none is without meaning. But if I do not know the meaning of the language, I shall be a foreigner to the speaker, and the speaker a foreigner to me. So, with yourselves, since you are eager for manifestations of the Spirit, strive to excel in building up the church. Therefore, he who speaks in a tongue should pray for the power to interpret. For if I pray in a tongue, my spirit prays, but my mind is unfruitful. What am I to do? I will pray with the spirit, and I will pray with the mind also. I will sing with the spirit, and I will sing with the mind also. Otherwise, if you bless with the spirit, how can anyone in the position of an outsider say the amen to your thanksgiving when he does not know what you are saying? For you may give thanks well enough, but the other man is not edified." And you are that other man, by the way, right now in this scenario, Michelle. So he says, "I thank God that I speak in tongues more than you all. Nevertheless, in church, I would rather speak five words with my mind in order to instruct others." What he means by that when he says five words with my mind, he means in the language that you and I both know. Speaking not in this mystical manner, but just speaking five words in, like you and I are speaking in English right now. He says, "In church, I would rather speak five words with my mind in order to instruct others than 10,000 words in a tongue. Brethren, do not be children in your thinking, be babes in evil, but in thinking be mature. In the law it is written, 'By men of strange tongues and by the lips of foreigners will I speak to this people, and even then they will not listen to me.'" And by the way, he's quoting a prophecy from the Old Testament that says, this is a sign, Israel, that when you're about to be overtaken and conquered and carried away by your oppressors, one of the signs that is imminent is you're going to start hearing strange tongues that you didn't hear before. Take that for what it's worth. Thus, he says, tongues are a sign not for believers, but for unbelievers, while prophecy is not for unbelievers, but for believers. If, therefore, the whole church assembles and all speak in tongues, and outsiders or unbelievers enter, will they not say that you are mad? But if all prophecy and an unbeliever or outsider enters, he is convicted by all, he is called to account to all. The secrets of his heart are disclosed, and so falling on his face, he will worship God and declare that God is really among you. What then, brethren? When you come together, each one has a hymn, a lesson, a revelation, a tongue, or an interpretation. Let all things be done for edification. If anyone speaks in a tongue, let there be only two or at most three, and each in turn let one interpret. In other words, unlike things that I have seen at charismatic events, when you've got everybody either speaking in a tongue or they think they're speaking in a tongue, that's not what St. Paul says here. He says, you know, one or two at most, or three at most, and only in turn, not all together. You speak, and then when you're done, that person speaks. And he says, but if there is no one to interpret, let each of them keep silence and speak to himself and to God. And he goes on from there. There are more rules that he lays down, but this is why, to return to your question, I realize, Michelle, this is somewhat of a long answer, but it's worthy of our consideration. We can say that, yes, there we do know that these gifts do exist for some people, but typically they're not exercised at all in the way that St. Paul requires, and what you saw is an example of that. But there's something else too, and that is that not everybody who thinks he or she is speaking in a tongue is. It may be that only few people are in fact speaking with a genuine charismatic gift, and the other people are just mimicking the sounds that they hear. I'm sorry to put it that way, but that's the truth. Some people so much want to speak in a tongue that they just start saying sounds that they hear other people saying. And that's not really the charismatic gift. That is just that person's imagination and desire to do something good. I don't fault them for that. But the human mind is capable of fooling itself. And I've seen it happen where people later would say, I have no clue. I really wasn't saying anything. I was just saying what I heard other people say. Which is all to say that it's unfortunate that she did that, because it's disruptive to other people like you. You're trying to pray. She's not following the biblical guideline. She may or may not have been actually speaking in a tongue in any case. And it's disruptive and divisive, and that's why you and I are talking about it today. So better, if she really felt she needed to pray in a tongue, just pray quietly under her breath, and she didn't have to make everybody in the Adoration Chapel hear what she was saying. So I guess you can see in conclusion, I'm saying that she went about it the wrong way, and I'm sorry you had to deal with that, and you probably were a bit distracted in your own prayers because of it.
Yeah, it was okay. I stay pretty calm when things happen. I just was, you know, it was just something. I've had very interesting things happen when I've been at my Adoration Hour. So It seemed to me that the mother, you know, was basically thought that it was kind of out of her control too. But very interesting. Thank you for your answer.
You're welcome, Michelle. Thank you. If she had been my daughter, I would have said to her afterward, don't do that anymore. Don't do that again. Pray quietly if you have to, but don't do that because it's disruptive. Thanks, Michelle. I'll be right back.
Irrelevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
This is funky. All right. The number is 888-914-9149. You can call. We'll get you on the air right now. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Brian in Minnesota. Hi, Brian.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Hi. What is your opinion of us eating food products that are fertilized by composted human bodies, since California is doing that now, and they signed into law last summer to allow composted human bodies used as fertilizer for food crops? And
yeah,
Colorado
has
done that. Yeah, I don't either. Colorado did that several years ago for food crops fed to animals. And then we eat the animals, and it feels like it's like a form of cannibalism to me. If I eat food that's fertilized by human bodies, and I just, what's your take on that?
I don't dig it. I don't like it. I'm not into it. I wouldn't do it. I'm agin it, as they might say in some parts of the country. I know that it's become somewhat fashionable in some eco-friendly circles to say, hey, let's compost these bodies because it's good for nature. And that's not the point of Christian burial. The point of Christian burial is to show due respect for the body. So I have heard and read a little bit on some people who promote this, and I'm not buying it. I don't agree with their conclusions. So I'm sorry to see it happening.
Sure. I don't know how many states are doing this, because I didn't even know about the Colorado thing until someone told me after California passed this law last summer. And, you know, how do we identify the food products that are being fertilized by human composted human bodies to avoid eating them? That's an issue.
Yeah, well, all I would say is, you know, when you're out shopping, don't buy Soylent Green. Don't buy
that. Listen to me, Hatcher. You got to tell them Soylent Green is people.
Definitely not. Well, thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome, Brian. Yeah, it's a unpleasant topic to think about, and it's unfortunate if you ask me. And yeah, I've heard some of the even quasi-theological arguments in favor of it. I definitely do not buy into those theories at all. So that was easy. Let's go now to Jackie in Doylestown, Pennsylvania. Hi, Jackie.
Hello, Patrick. My question is, how are you? My question is, I grew up in a Catholic school, and there was always nuns. Today, you barely see nuns. Where are they?
Yeah, they don't exist. Since Vatican II, there's been a steep, very steep decline in the number of religious sisters, not to mention priests, seminarians, etc. You know who's got some statistics at his fingertips? If you go on Twitter, one of the people I stay in touch with on Twitter, he goes by the handle Mr. Casey, and he lately has been publishing some graphs, some statistics that come from CARA. It's an acronym, C-A-R-A, and I have to try to remember what that acronym stands for, but it's a Catholic sociological survey organization. I think it's connected to Catholic University, if I'm not mistaken, in Washington, D.C., and so I think he's getting the statistics from them, and they're quite fascinating, but they're very dismal. So his handle, if you want to look him up, is Mr. Casey, C-A-S-E-Y, 6-2. And if you just peruse his timeline on Twitter, you'll see a lot of the statistics, which in essence answer your question, like, well, where are they? They don't exist anymore, because a lot of these religious orders have imploded and some have completely disbanded. Others are just a shell of their former selves. The number of women who are coming in to religious life as postulants is greatly diminished since Vatican II. The same is true for seminarians. The same is true for priests. The same is true for religious priests. And when you see the numbers and you see the statistics, you say, oh my gosh, we just fell off a cliff. So as that happened, the population of Catholics in this country has increased because the population as a whole has increased. So the percentage of Catholics, which, as I understand it, is right around 21%, thereabouts, of the population. The number of Catholics has increased, but the number of men and women who are serving in those capacities has dramatically decreased. So that's what you're seeing.
Patrick, excuse my ignorance, but what occurred in Vatican II that caused this?
Well, depends on whom you ask. You'll get different answers from different people. I was a child when Vatican II ended, so I was about 6 years old when it all wrapped up. I don't really remember, you know, other than a childhood memory of it, which doesn't amount to much. But as a teenager getting into the 1970s, I saw firsthand just the dramatic change in the way the Catholic faith was presented, and wild permutations and really serious liturgical abuses and things that began almost immediately. And the flames were fanned not by the council documents per se, but by I don't even know if well-meaning is accurate. In some cases, it probably was, but misguided people, priests, nuns especially, who were telling lay people all kinds of crazy things in the name of the council or in the spirit of Vatican II. So things like birth control, to use an example. In 1968, Pope Paul VI, he issued his landmark encyclical, Humanae Vitae. This ties into your question, Jackie. And he reiterated the church's age-old teaching that contraception is a serious moral evil, and the church does not condone it or permit it. Well, in the years from the time of Vatican II, and even maybe a bit before that, priests more and more were telling lay people in confession, it's fine. You want to be on the pill, that's fine. You want to use a condom, that's fine. The church is going to change its teaching anyway. And, you know, it's just a matter of time. So go ahead and do that. And then when Pope Paul VI issued Humanae Vitae in 1968, it caused unbelievable outrage, largely among the clergy. So much so, Jackie, that there were a group of, I would call them renegade priests. There may even have been some bishops on this as well, but certainly it was the preponderance of them were priests. They took out like a full-page ad denouncing Pope Paul VI and denouncing Humanae Vitae. I think it was the New York Times. If I had a moment to Google it, I could find it, and you could see this ad if you wanted to. So you had this attack on the church and her teachings led by priests. And this kind of thing was deeply destructive, especially of lay people, because they were being told all that stuff that you used to hear about before, and no meat on Fridays, and you got to go to Mass on Sunday. None of that's not important anymore. And the message was heard loud and clear, because my theory is that water seeks the path of least resistance. And if it's easier to go downhill, go downhill. So what happened was, in my view, it had a cascading effect in which, whether it was on the issue of birth control or sexual issues in general, or just doctrine, the importance of the Holy Eucharist and the Mass and things like that, the message was sent by enough priests that lay people didn't have to worry about those things anymore. And it created a kind of unraveling effect that more and more and more it took hold, to the point where fewer and fewer young men and young women were interested in going into the seminary or religious life, because it just was no longer what it used to be in their eyes. And so in huge numbers, not only did people stop applying for the seminary or for religious life, but those who were in the seminary and even in the priesthood too, they were abandoning ship. They were running off and getting married, and priests and nuns and all kinds of stuff. It just was unbelievably chaotic in many ways, in the 70s, certainly, even before that. And so, and I talk about a cascading effect, one of the effects that it had was it just completely dampened any former fervor on the part of young people to be interested in those vocations. And the numbers tell the tale. So now we're living with Go ahead, Jackie.
I was just going to say, that really helps me understand, and I'll do a little research, but obviously, you know, the laws are what they are, and they didn't want to abide by them. So rather than say, you know, I don't want to be a priest because, you know, I'm going to tell people they can use birth control, or I'm going to tell them that they can have sex outside of marriage, and they just decided, you know what, I'm not going to become a priest.
Yeah, that's essentially what happened for many people. Now, I don't want to be accused of being simplistic. And the thing that we have to point out is that there were many factors that conspired to bring about what we see as this precipitous decline in Catholic, the metrics that we just talked about. So Catholic vocations to the priesthood, etc. Now, let me give you some sources that may help you understand. First of all, be familiar with the documents themselves, because if you're not familiar with them, you won't really know what was at issue here. One big part of it was the shock to the system when Vatican II changed the Mass. It changed the rite of the Mass, and it fashioned a new Mass. This is why it's known as the Novus Ordo. That means the new order of the Mass. It said the Mass should be celebrated in the vernacular, whatever country you happen to be in. The changes that were made were so abrupt, and there was so little preparation for the faithful that it was, you had a whiplash. Like, oh my gosh, what's going on here? Why is this changing? And everything that I was taught and everything that I knew to be true, the church is now saying, not so much. Or at least that's how it appeared to some people. So one book I would recommend by the late Ralph McInerney, it's called What Went Wrong with Vatican II, The Catholic Crisis Explained. Now I'm going to give you a spoiler here. I'll tell you what his conclusion is, but you really should read the book. His conclusion is Humanae Vitae, the 1968 encyclical that Pope Paul VI issued that I talked about. He said that is like the flashpoint where the quote-unquote spirit of Vatican II movement, and let's do anything that we want to in the name of the spirit of Vatican II, even though the church documents didn't call for many of these things. He traces the confusion and just the general mayhem to the rejection of Humanae Vitae. That's his thesis. But when you get to the punchline in the book, you realize this is a really strong thesis. It makes a lot of sense. So that's one book called What Went Wrong with Vatican II. It's by Ralph McInerney. Another book I'd recommend is called The Rhine Flows into the Tiber. Now, this is a book that was not written by a partisan. So Father Ralph Wiltgen, W-I-L-T-G-E-N, is the author. He was, I believe he was a Vincentian, if I'm not mistaken, and he was a trained journalist. And he, as an American journalist, was there in Rome running one of the main hubs of coverage of the Vatican Council during the times that it met. And so he didn't have an axe to grind. He wasn't a partisan. He wasn't pushing one perspective over another. He was just simply reporting on it for the English reading press. And what's amazing is he's just telling you how there was this struggle between the liberalizing forces in Europe, primarily in Germany, and the more traditional sources, primarily in Italy, and how those on the liberal side, they really did win a lot of the skirmishes and many of the major battles, such that the original plans for Vatican II from Pope John XXIII and his close collaborators were radically altered. And so rather than it being a council that included, in addition to, you know, trying to reach out to the world in a language the modern world could understand, some things that were necessary, the original intention was to include a thorough reaffirmation of traditional Catholic teaching. And the people on the left, they wanted exactly the opposite. And so they did dumb things. They did cruel things, like when you have Cardinal Ottaviani, for example, who was one of the major figures on the traditional side of things during the council. They would just simply switch his mic off. Like, he would get up to explain something or talk about why this is important. They would just cut his mic so that nobody could hear what he had to say. So his book, Ralph Wiltgen's book, The Rhine Flows into the Tiber, is in real time, you might say, contemporary with what was happening. He's just explaining these are the things that are happening. These are the things these people are saying and they're doing. But he wasn't pushing an agenda one way or the other. He was just reporting on it. Okay. So that's another. There are several other books, but I'll leave it at those two to start. But if you read them, I think you'll have a clear understanding. But do read the documents too. That's important. If you don't read the documents, you won't even know really what the big struggle is all about. And it's a struggle that continues to this day, unfortunately. Thanks, Jackie. I'll be right back.